Here comes the 306th edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. At the risk of damaging my reputation, I have some good news. I'm normally a law and order kind of guy, driving the speed limits and no longer smuggling drugs or any of that stuff. However, my hat's off to the Canadians who defied our new draconian anti-terrorism laws by chipping in to bring Abu Sufyan Abdulrazak home from exile in Sudan. He's been living in Khartoum's Canadian embassy for months, while Harper's regime stymied all efforts to return him to his family. The latest ploy was to demand that he have a prepaid plane ticket, adding that it's illegal for any Canadian to give or lend this impecunious citizen any funds, as he is on a list. Well, this news prompted 115 Canadians to contribute to a Facebook fund buying him a ticket. So the ball is in the government's court. Will they now issue documents allowing this man to return to his family? Will they prosecute 115 generous Canadians, including former Solicitor General Warren Ullman and David Orchard, the man who betrayed by Peter McKay? Under Ottawa's bullshit anti-terrorism laws, each donor could face 10 years in the slammer. Stay tuned for news on how Harper treats this mess. Meanwhile, we have a further miscarriage of justice in the American colony of Iraq. Mutandar al-Zaidi was sentenced by Iraq's puppet government to 3 years imprisonment for the stunt of throwing his shoes at former President George Bush. This is too harsh a penalty for this man, although he is without a doubt guilty of missing Bush not once, but twice. Perhaps if he had had a third shoe. Last week, I put my wife on a plane headed back east to join her siblings, keeping a watch on their ailing great-aunt, age 93, who's been the matriarch of the family for years. She's well-loved, well enough to draw the family in from their diaspora. As the designated correspondent of our household, I've exchanged letters with this woman for decades. If she doesn't survive this episode, I'll certainly miss her. For 3 decades, she's lived on retirement income from General Motors, so, to be strictly callous, her expiration at this time would be prudent, as that company's on a slide which may obliterate future retirement benefits for many thousands. Welcome to reality in 2009. The impacts of Vancouver's billion-dollar exercise in applied paranoia are surfacing. During the Olympic party, some businesses will have to close as they are within an arbitrary security zone. We're assured that laid-off victims of these closures will have no problem selling hot dogs and souvenirs to visitors. No problem at all. Short-hop flights into Vancouver from rural BC and the islands were previously free of heavy security screening. One could fly from Haida Gwaii to the Big Smoke with nail clippers in the pocket. Official paranoids demand full-scale searches during the friendly little games, so puddle jumper flights may suspend service for a couple of weeks. Too bad for those needing to travel, swim, hitchhike, walk, bus, or take a boat. Oh no, scratch that bus. Those may be restricted also. 1 year to go, and as time unfolds, we'll hear more ways in which lives and businesses are to be disrupted as $1 billion is spent to keep the partygoers cuddly safe in 2010. Canada is full of addicts. We have alcoholics, gambling addicts, shopaholics, workaholics, nicotine fiends, and chronic spendthrifts. So who does our government spend billions to persecute, prosecute, and incarcerate? Drug users. We don't send the cops after gamblers for all the damage that gambling does to our society. Governments bend over backwards to promote gambling as a cash cow. Let the suckers put their money down, draining the real economy and wrecking families, as long as governments get a cut of the proceeds. Alcohol is likewise a source of tax income as it destroys lives of addicts. We restrict public smoking and the purchase of dangerous nicotine vehicles, but we don't jail these addicts. Tobacco sales are another cash cow. Granted that cocaine, heroin, methamphetamines, and a whole pharmacy of others can be addictive and problematic for society, why pick on a common weed, marijuana? As for the addictive drugs, public and private harm can be reduced by prescription maintenance when coupled with withdrawal programs and public information. Marijuana is not physically addictive. Usage can become habit-forming, but on a par with and less harmful than many other minor habits. No one advocates marijuana for minors. THC is not conducive to learning, nor is it recommended for drivers. They tend to block traffic when stoned. But as a relaxant for adults' leisure hours, who cares? As a minor participant in the U.S. occupation of the Panama Canal Zone, I learned that the Army was composed largely of two slightly overlapping groups, drinkers and dope smokers. Drinkers kept the military police busy when they brawled. The harm caused by those stoned on grass was more subtle and continues to be so for society at large. The high induced by marijuana is conducive to thinking outside the box. Barriers to imagination are lowered, and irreverent questions can surface. Drunken soldiers are more likely to wrap themselves in the flag and be in the my country right or wrong camp, spoiling for a fight. Smokers often laid back and questioned what the hell they were doing in Panama. Why was our nation wasting its resources and manpower on the unwanted occupation of a strip of land extorted by force, bifurcating a supposedly independent nation? We were using antiquated weapons, including World War II anti-aircraft guns, to guard a ditch that would have become irrelevant 15 minutes after the outbreak of war with our only perceived enemy. This was subversive thinking. Might such turns of thought be what truly drives right-wing ideologues to condemn pot? Antagonism is deeply rooted in this powerful group, and its influence is spread worldwide. International treaties and conventions promoted by the states force more reasoning nations to criminalize the weed. Here in Canada, where we are more rational, we cannot decriminalize grass. This is a bit of sovereignty we have sacrificed in the face of severe repercussions for failure to do so. Until the United States loosens up and admits that prosecution of dope smoking is the solution in search of a problem, the overstarched clowns of the right will continue to make life miserable for smokers and very lucrative for growers and distributors. One day we may see cannabis sold through liquor stores, with supplies controlled and the underworld reduced to seeking legal employment. I should live so long. Speaking of overstarched conservatives, UNBC's very own alumnus, James Moore, now Minister of Heritage, has denied more funding to the CBC. Isn't it odd that at a time when billions are being thrown at supposed stimulus of the economy, money is denied to this vital Canadian institution? What better way to get money flowing again than to spend it where it will go to employing Canadians and producing and distributing shows, strengthening our sense of national identity? I suppose it's foolishly wishful for me to think that conservatives, even our stuffed shirt James Moore, would advocate promoting Canadian unity. This party is in bed with the United States while holding its collective nose at Obama's liberal stench wafting across our border. Better to show our subservience to failing American automakers than give funds to a subversive Canadian institution offending Fox News. Harper wants a blank check of billions to distribute as he sees fit, and our wimpish Liberal Party can do no better than to demand ex post facto accounting. Save your Canadian flags. They're liable to join Confederate money as collector's items one day, if they're not made illegal. Now we know why Canada's sending soldiers to the killing fields of Afghanistan. Our dear leader, to cop a phrase from the North Koreans, while admitting our inability to defeat the Afghans, pledges our soldiers in silver for another 2 years to lend credibility to Peter McKay's bid for appointment as Secretary General of NATO. Using our sacrifices as street cred, this man's ambition may be achieved. Before the esoteric process of recruiting takes place, I hope those doing the choosing will examine McKay's resume. His salient qualification is his betrayal of a written undertaking given to David Orchard, then a power in the Progressive Conservative Party. He promised, that in exchange for Orchard's leadership support, he would not engage in negotiations to merge with Harper's Radical Alliance. The ink was not dry on that agreement before the new PC leader merged the PCs with the alliance, creating the current Conservative Party. Considering McKay's blatant betrayal of a solemn undertaking in that case, what might he do as leader of NATO? This SOB wouldn't hesitate to launch World War III if it suited his ambitions. Let's hope NATO has more sense than to give this dubious clown any more power than he now has. It's been almost 2 years since then-Defense Minister Gordon O'Connor announced that Canada would be buying 100 Leopard 2 tanks and lease another 20 to support our troops in Afghanistan. So, where are they? We blew $1.3 billion for these machines, and now 80 of them are in storage in Montreal and Europe. Meanwhile, our soldiers are being killed on Afghan roads in inferior vehicles. Army chiefs warn that equipment is breaking down rapidly in the harsh Afghan theater, their term, while shiny new tanks sit in warehouses. Delay is costing Canadian lives, and our current defense minister will do no more than bluster. And who is this defense minister? None other than the aforementioned Peter MacKay. Shall we rechristen the frequent ramp ceremonies for boxed soldiers MacKay homecomings? We live in a time of many threats. For the better part of a decade, we've been scared silly of terrorism. So scared that we sacrificed many precious rights, freedoms, and a good measure of our privacy. We stare down the barrel of a recession, threatening to morph into a depression. We're warned that only massive transfers of foolishly acquired private debt to public debt will prevent disaster. We're threatened by crime, especially here in Prince George, a city which Maclean's magazine says is the fourth most dangerous in Canada. We're threatened by a monomaniac from Sussex Drive who intends to transform our country into an imitation of Indonesia if we allow him a majority in Parliament. We're so accustomed to being surrounded by perceived threats that we barely blink when Chrysler Corporation demands that we lend them $2.3 billion, in U.S. dollars no less. Failing this loan, that carpetbagger company will close up shop and move production of their unwanted vehicles to the States, firing some 9,000 Canadian employees. Converted to Canadian dollars, that comes to almost a half million for each job. Wow. This threat deserves to be analyzed. First, was that really a loan? Would it be repaid with or without interest? Supposed government loans to faltering enterprises have a bad record of defaults or forgiveness by subsequent governments. If such a loan were a good deal, why is no private investor interested? Might it be that knowledgeable people would consider it to be money thrown down a rat hole? Then there's the demand that the union take a 25% cut as part of the deal. Sounds pretty bold coming from executives who've milked the company for many millions in bloated salaries. They want Canadian workers to cost them no more than scab workers in states of the Old South. If wages reach that level, would they demand parity with Romanian wage slaves? Oh, yes. Their threat to pack up and leave includes a demand that the federal government abandon its suit against Chrysler for tax avoidance scheme costing our treasury $1 billion. Well, two sides can make threats. Suppose our government had the gumption to tell Chrysler that it will continue to produce vehicles here, or else. Or else we'll slap a duty of $10,000 on every future Chrysler product they import. Or else we will expropriate every abandoned asset to be auctioned to the highest bidder. There are giants like Toyota who would love to produce more here. That we will continue that suit for fraudulently avoiding taxes and, upon winning, place a lien on their assets anywhere in the world that we can find them. This country and our leaders need to recall that corporations are creations of government charters. They're allowed to operate as entities protecting investors' personal assets behind the corporate veil, but only on condition that the corporation obey the laws of the land and serve the public good. When a corporation, as an artificial person under the law, ceases to serve a need and fails to obey the laws of the land, its charter can be revoked and it ceases to exist. There are the threats we can hold over the head of Chrysler Canada Incorporated. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. While Harper contemplates giving a dubious loan to a failing auto company, James Moore, whose ample bottom now fills the chair of Minister of Heritage, has other plans. He intends to cut $44.8 million in arts and culture funding from his ministry's budget next fall. This amount, though huge, is barely 2% of what Chrysler demands to save 9,000 jobs. 2% of 9,000 is what, math students? 180 auto worker jobs at Chrysler's price. Can you imagine how many artists and cultural workers will lose employment due to these cuts? If not thousands, I'll eat my hat. Moore claims that we will eliminate only programs which have been dogged by wastefulness and inefficiency, but he refuses to tell what standards were used to make the decision. If Harper's Conservatives wanted to save money by excluding recipients whose operations were dogged by wastefulness and inefficiency, I suggest they might start looking at those financial parasites precipitating this recession. No, these people will be rewarded for their greed and incompetence, but various artists living on the fringe have no ties to Harper's party, so to hell with them. Harper admits that insurgent forces in Afghanistan probably cannot be defeated militarily. His government further confesses that Western-style democracy has little chance of taking root in that society. So what are we doing there? Ah, yes, we're protecting the rights of women and the opportunity of children to attend school. Bullshit. Look at the case of the Afghan journalism student convicted of blasphemy for questioning in class Islam's treatment of women. He was found guilty of distributing an article from the internet. Horrors. He allegedly accused the Prophet Muhammad of writing portions of the Quran to justify his own actions. Islamic courts knew that every word of the Quran was dictated by God, so the student was sentenced to death. This was commuted to a mere 20 years in prison on appeal when it was proven that a witness had perjured himself. The Afghan Supreme Court upheld the sentence, in secret, in direct violation of Afghan law, guaranteeing that defense counsel was entitled to be present. This is why we are sending the flower of our youth to fight and die in that godforsaken country. That is why we are buying phantom tanks and spending billions on fighting a war against the whole people. If Canadians were to wake up and put facts together, would we not pull our troops out of that country forthwith and turf the prime minister who keeps them there? I've long held, based on experience, that a great problem with prison systems in both the U.S. and Canada is their lack of quality captives. We incarcerate all too many street-level petty criminals and drug offenders and not enough people with class. We made a good start by locking up Conrad Black, Martha Stewart, and Bernie Madoff, but we need more of the same. Conrad has engaged himself in teaching fellow convicts. Martha's writing a book on tasteful cell arrangements and accessories. We have yet to see what Bernie will contribute, perhaps a book on finance. Barack Obama is taking great strides toward upping prison standards as he pressures Switzerland's UBS Bank to release the names of some 52,000 American citizens holding secret accounts there. If this inland tax haven can be pressured to yield account information leading to convictions for tax evasion, Yankee prisons may soon see an influx of quality residents. If Switzerland can be pressured to yield on their precious secrecy policies, can other tax havens fail to follow? Down like dominoes go Luxembourg, the Bahamas, the British Virgin Islands, and the rest. They might resist, but soon rumors could spread that Luxembourg is a haven for terrorists, the Bahamas is harboring weapons of mass destruction, and the British Virgin Islands is secretly refining uranium. Say, why are we wasting effort on an unwinnable war against Afghanistan, eh? Tapping back taxes and assessing penalties on wealthy individuals could not just make for more fashionable jails, but wipe out a good portion of the U.S. deficit. Wouldn't we all like to see those multimillionaires who think themselves too good to pay their share of taxes squirm? Of course, I would expect the government of Canada to ride American coattails on this one, even though we haven't enough of an army left to take on the Bahamas, much less the Luxembourg Palace Guards. Britons are finally organizing to oppose government trampling on their liberties and privacy. Rallies in several cities have protested intrusive surveillance and personal records compiled in the name of fighting terrorism. They're frightened by the way their government, a supposed labor government, mines data including travel information, telephone records, DNA banks, and emails to assemble profiles. There's an ongoing plan to introduce mandatory identification cards that citizens will have to carry at all times. This one sounds familiar to me because, as a young man, I was required to carry an American draft card. Failure to pack this piece of paper could have resulted in a 5-year prison sentence. Naturally, this penalty was used only selectively against those the government wanted to harass. When I attained Canadian citizenship, I joined thousands of previous protesters in burning this nasty item. A European court ordered Britain to destroy the DNA records of 800,000 innocent Britons, but the administration has ignored the ruling, claiming these records can be, quote, useful. We condemn the East German Stasi for keeping detailed records on all of its citizens. Should we not do the same with Great Britain? And do we really know what kind of records Harper's government is accumulating? Alberta's Beaver Lake Cree Nation is fighting the provincial government for promoting headlong development of tar sands extraction on their traditional territory. They base their battle on an 1876 treaty under which the band surrendered large areas of land in exchange for the guarantee that, quote, as long as the sun shines, the rivers flow, and the grass grows, we can continue our traditional way of life, close quote. You see the loophole there. The use of the conjunction requires all three conditions continued for the guarantee to be in force. The sun continues to shine all right, but the rivers are rapidly drying up, and effluent from tar sands mines endangers the very grass. Too bad, Beaver Lake Nation. Your negotiators should have included or rather than and. Better luck next time. Thanks to our big sister station in Nelson, CJLY, Prince George listeners can hear rebroadcast of Deconstructing Dinner on CFUR. That show may well be second in popularity only to Democracy Now! From New York. A recurrent theme of Deconstructing Dinner is the wastefulness of expanding world production of meat as opposed to plant products. It takes more energy and vegetable matter to produce a calorie of meat than the equivalent from plant-based foods. With today's precarious balance between production and consumption, either we'll have to cut back on meats or prices of all food will rise to the point where those in the third world will starve. Right now, there's increasing world hunger as calories are exported to wealthy countries, making them unaffordable to those on the margins. I wish and hope, but do not expect, those of us in the developed world will voluntarily reduce our meat eating in order to save the hidden, huddled masses in the four countries. Most of us are oblivious to their plight. To hell with them, give me a big juicy steak. Time is running out, as we might say with the tip of a hat to the bygone 60s. This is the dawning of the age of asparagus. Don't groan, it only encourages me. I'm blasting my way through a slim volume of some 67 pages is Christianity Good for the World? This is the transcript of a debate first published in Christianity Today between Christopher Hitchens and Douglas Wilson. The former is the author of God is Not Great, who stands for the negative case. The latter is a pastor of a church in Moscow, Idaho, and needs no explanation. I'm embarrassed for the good pastor as I read his comments. It's a shame to witness a battle of wits where one combatant is unarmed. Hitchens carries on, attempting to parry Wilson's arguments, but it all boils down to whether religion leads individuals to acts that are socially beneficial. It seems odd that the argument hinges on whether faith is valuable while skirting the issue whether faith has any foundation. This is akin to arguing whether belief in visiting aliens is good for society while failing to address whether there are visitors from outer space. Before reading this debate, I thought that rationalizations for belief in the supernatural could be summarized on a matchbook. Now I think they could be written on a match. 4 long years ago, I did what a lot of my listeners did or are doing. I attended university, or universities as fate would have it. I lost a semester at my first, after which I dropped out for 3 years in the military, then a year and a half in another institution, and 2 in yet another. Finally, I achieved that precious degree. My goal in all those grinding years was graduate school, and I was, indeed, admitted to one of my choice, with a teaching fellowship, no less. But I was burned out pretty thoroughly by those 4 years of undergraduate study, and I arranged to defer enrollment by a year so that I could take a break and make some money. That year changed my trajectory, although I didn't realize it at the time. The next fall, I began classes, becoming aware of a couple things pretty soon. I was not interested in teaching, and I didn't much care for a career in a suit. I'd watched my father commute to his stressful job and listened to him bitch most nights about all the troubles in his office. On and on it went, finally catching up with him and killing him a year after he retired. That wasn't for me. During that interim year, I found that actually working physically and seeing a real product of my efforts was satisfying. When I showered and returned to my apartment, my time was my own, and I didn't carry cares with me from the job. I made friends with some fine men and enjoyed myself. Toward the end of my first semester in grad school, I dropped out unceremoniously and headed for Toronto, arriving as a squeaky clean landed immigrant. Since then, I've taken a number of jobs, carefully avoiding anything smacking of a career. One job I fell into was a petty one of handling supply operations for a government bureaucracy here in Prince George. I shouldered the duties of ordering pencils in multitudes of forms, keeping a horde of fussy folks happy. Keeping assigned spaces clear in the employee parking lot also fell to me. Those of you who've worked in any bureaucracy know how important parking spaces can be to bureaucrats, public or private. They represent important symbols of rank and power. May the gods protect and pity anyone encroaching on those precious rectangles of assigned real estate. I had fun with this function. Across the street was the telephone building, and it was not uncommon for drivers to slip into our well-signed private lot while paying their bills. Parking meters lined both sides of the street, but some good folks just couldn't bear to part with a nickel to park there. I attacked the job of keeping the lot clear with a vengeance. Northern Towing was available on short order, and I wasn't shy about calling their truck. 3 or 4 times a week, I would find some perplexed individual seeking his or her missing auto, and I would graciously inform them of where it could be found. One glorious day, I looked out upon my domain to see a shiny new car in an employee's place. Hallelujah! It bore a dealer's plate. I love car dealers. Soon that shiny new car rested in Northern Towing's lot. The next day, I surveyed the lot to discover an almost identical vehicle of a different color in exactly the same spot and bearing a plate just one digit above yesterday's. A slow learner, thought I. Off it went on Northern Towing's hook. I returned to my mundane task, but soon heard a commotion in the office. A gentleman was raising his voice in a most ungentlemanly manner, gesticulating wildly among threats of legal violence. Sure enough, it was the driver of that second car. It seems his wife had parked there the day before to visit the telephone office. When the car was towed, she complained to hubby, who returned this day to complain while duplicating her offense. Said gentleman insisted on calling the cops, and soon an officer appeared to hear his demands. "I want that person arrested for auto theft," said he, pointing at me. The cop then stepped outside with the gentleman and pointed to the signs, asking whether he understood them. It was a private lot, and unknown vehicles would be towed. That was pretty clear. Again, the gentleman arose in high dudgeon, demanding that the officer call his supervisor. "Well," said the cop, "it happens this is our lunch hour, and I am the supervisor." That incident was almost as much fun as the day my boss arrived in a new car, the license number of which he had not given to me. When I mentioned to co-workers that I had towed a car from Mr. Brown's spot, they informed me of his acquisition. It was left to me, with a good score of people at my back, to inform Mr. Brown. He was not amused. He threw his keys at me and said, "Get it!" How could anyone exchange adventures like that for a crummy career? This concludes the 306th edition of CFUR's Porcupine Petting Zoo at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Robert Ingersoll once said, "I know nothing about God. I've always lived, you see, in one of the rural districts of the universe."